Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we'll be investigating the history of cannibalism, from stories in the Bible to Hannibal Lecter. We'll also be talking about the Irish Protestants who were involved in the 1916 Rising and who were forgotten about afterwards. We'll hear about the history of heartthrobs, from Mr. Darcy to Christian Grey. We'll discuss the relationship between religion and magic throughout history. And then to end the show, we'll find out how Hitler and the Nazis looked to American laws to influence their racial policies. We'd love you to take part in our discussion by texting us at any time on 53106, that's 4.30, or you can email us at talkinghistory@newstalk.com. Last week we looked at the Battle of Hastings and we found out about 1066 and all that. And if you want to listen back to that or any of our older shows, just go to our website newstalk.com or go directly to iTunes. But we begin the show with a book that I have to say I really enjoyed reading over the weekend, because it is, as the subtitle says, a natural and unnatural history of cannibalism. The book is called Eat Me. It's published in hardback by Profile Books and costs £14.99 sterling, so about €18. The author is Bill Shutt. And Bill, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Great to be on your show, Patrick.
Okay, I'm going to begin with Hannibal Lecter, because you begin the book with a quote in your prologue from Hannibal Lecter. And when we mention, when someone mentions cannibalism now, it's hard not to think of Hannibal Lecter and, of course, Anthony Hopkins' great performance.
Sure. I think that's, there's a knee-jerk reaction that we have when you hear the term cannibalism, and people automatically think about Hannibal Lecter or Jeffrey Dahmer or the guys that were stranded up in the Andes and wound up having to cannibalize their dead friends. And I think there's a reason for that, and that turned out to be a pretty interesting take that on cannibalism that I got to explore writing this book.
And you mentioned as well about how Norman Bates has his roots in the cannibal tradition, because he's based, even though the movie Psycho doesn't deal with it, he's based on a real-life serial killer who was a cannibal.
Yeah, Ed Gein. And when Robert Bloch wrote the novella Psycho, he sort of left out the cannibalistic aspect of Ed Gein's crimes, and he concentrated on the mother obsession and the murdering.
The book is in two parts. The first part looks at cannibalism in nature, and the second part looks at humans. I was fascinated by the sections, the chapters on the animal kingdom, because first you explode the myths of the black spider being such a dangerous creature, and you look at, I suppose, the times when cannibalism does naturally occur.
Yeah, it was a real surprise to me when I started to write the section on animals that cannibalism was actually as widespread as it was in the animal kingdom. Up until recently, the party line among scientists had been that if you wanted to see cannibalism, it was going to be a couple of weirdos like black widow spiders or praying mantises, but that the rest of the cannibalism that you saw in nature would probably be related to a lack of food or from captive conditions. But what I found was that cannibalism was extremely widespread throughout the entire animal kingdom. Frequency varies among groups, from extremely common in animals like insects and snails to more or less rare in primates, for reasons that were a real surprise to me, like parental care or as a reproductive strategy.
And sometimes it could be stress-related.
Absolutely.
So there you have, I suppose, where cannibalism and how it occurs in the animal kingdom. But let's take it on to the human world, because
sure,
that was really quite extraordinary. First of all, I had never any idea that Christopher Columbus had played a role in coming up with the name cannibal that we have, because it comes from the Latin for dog and it relates to some of his travels in 1493.
Yes, there's a bit of controversy about whether the term cannibalism came from canis, or if it came from a mistranslation of Carib, which were the native people that he found. But in any event, once he realized that there wasn't a lot of gold in the Caribbean, then they started to look for another resource, and that turned out to be humans. And so on his initial voyage, the natives were described as nice folks, and they fit to to work for the Queen, but the Queen wrote him back and said, "Listen, if certainly in not these words, but if these people are gentle and kind as you say, then you need to treat them well. But if they're cannibals, then all bets are off." And essentially, what happened was that by, I'm sure, no coincidence, his second, third, and fourth voyages were more like invasions, and the term cannibal was then applied to anybody who showed any type of resistance to being enslaved or brutalized.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. It became an excuse to enslave these native populations, because mm-hmm. once you had that cloak, that excuse of saying the cannibalism was going on, it seemed to justify completely doing anything to them. And you had the Pope decreeing cannibalism a sin in 1510. So you were getting all kinds of sanction for what you wanted to do.
Yeah, if you were called if someone was calling you a cannibal, then you were not a human, and so therefore normal rules of behavior did not apply anymore, and people could be hunted, and you know, it's more like pest control than anything else.
Extraordinary. Now, then you take the story a little bit further back, and you look at the times when cannibalism is mentioned in the Bible. Are there many examples?
Well, you're really talking about two different types of mentioning of cannibalism in the Bible. One has to do with siege-related cannibalism, where you've got cities that are surrounded and there's no food, and the people who are within those cities are forced to cannibalize their dead.
What about more modern examples? Because you have a section on people who like to eat the placenta after childbirth. Could that be considered cannibalism?
Yeah, I think so. And this was another really surprising aspect of the book. For on the animal side of it, it was just how common it was. And for human cannibalism, it was how pervasive medicinal cannibalism was throughout Europe for hundreds of years, starting in the Middle Ages, running through the Renaissance, and right up until the early part of the 19th century. Just about every body part that you can envision, from skulls and bones to guts and blood, were used in all sorts of medical treatments to treat everything from epilepsy to headaches. And so I think the last vestiges of that are among some people who follow alternative medicine, who believe that by consuming their placentas after they give birth, that it smooths out the ups and downs, the hormonal ups and downs that take place after childbirth. You know, it's not widespread, but it's something that I investigated and actually got a chance. I was invited to partake in that.
And did you?
Yeah, funny story. It turned out to be incredibly interesting. I'd started my semester. I'd been traveling all around for working on this book, and I teach. And my semester had started, and I'd started to do this research on consuming placentas. And the woman that I contacted, you know, I figured it was going to be email or Skype, and she said, "Well, it's too bad, because if you come down here, you could eat my placenta. I just gave birth, and I've got it in my freezer." And this was a person who prepared placentas professionally for her clients. So I'm thinking to myself, if it's 10 years down the road and I've written a book about cannibalism and I got the chance to actually go down there and try it, and she's like, "Well, you know, my husband's a chef. He can make it any way you want it. Osso buco, we can make a taco out of it." And I'm thinking to myself, you know, 10 years down the road, if I said no, I'd be kicking myself in the behind. So I got off the phone and grabbed tickets to Dallas and flew down there and met her family, and the rest turned out to be one of the more interesting stories in the book.
You end the book by referencing the Charlton Heston classic from 1973, Soylent Green. I think we're allowed to give away spoilers now because it is a movie older than me. But it's a movie that has at its heart cannibalism. That's the big twist at the end.
Yeah, in a sense that the environment in the future became so toxic that this food that they were passing out to everybody, Soylent Green, was supposed to be made from algae, and that in reality the sea was so poisoned that they couldn't sustain the algae that they claimed they would use for Soylent Green, and so they would use humans, and people would go to they would go to basically sites where they were euthanized once they hit a certain age, and instead of being buried or whatever they were telling people they were doing with the bodies, they were making them into Soylent Green. Hence the famous quote, "Soylent Green is people."
Soylent Green is, people, a fantastic movie. Okay, well, Bill, congratulations on the book. It's called Eat Me, A Natural and Unnatural History of Cannibalism. It's published in hardback by Profile Books and costs $14.99 sterling, so about €18. And we're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be talking about the Irish Protestants who were involved in the 1916 Rising. So stay with us here on News Talk.
Talking History with Patrick Gagan on Newstalk 106 to 108.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. Later in the show, we're going to be finding out how Hitler and the Nazis looked to the United States for ideas about how to develop their racial legislation in the 1930s. But right now, we are talking about the Irish Protestant nationalists who were involved in the 1916 Rising. A wonderful historian, Valerie Jones, for the last number of years was working on a major project on the forgotten story of Protestant radical nationalists who were involved in the 1916 Rising. Unfortunately, Valerie passed away before she was able to bring the book to publication, but her daughter, the wonderful historian Professor Heather Jones, has now brought the book to completion. It's published in hardback by Ashfield Press and costs €25. All of the royalties go to the Irish Cancer Society, and if you buy the book directly from the Church of Ireland's website, even more goes to the Irish Cancer Society because they have very kindly waived all administrative fees for it. So I caught up with Heather during the week to talk to me about, well, I suppose about the book, about the project, and about bringing it to completion. And I began by asking her about how this was a very personal project for her.
It was indeed, yes. It was something I promised my mother when we knew she was very ill that I would do for her, that her work would be put in the public domain. I think she was quite worried that all the research she'd done would come to nothing because she was very ill and she thought she wouldn't live to see it published. So, yeah, I promised her I'd publish it.
And you've written very powerfully about this in the Irish Times, about you were pregnant at the time. You waited, I think, until your baby was born because your father, very sadly as well, passed away soon after. It was a difficult time for you to, but in a way, I suppose it was a way of reconnecting with your mother then as well, by going over the words she had written to bring the book to completion.
Yes, I mean, a bit of background. My father died 6 months after my mother. So then working on the book became quite difficult. I was pregnant and I actually was living in London, so I was quite far from home. And one of the things that I did was I waited until my baby was born, and then I was able to actually work on it. And it was a nice way of getting back in touch with that world at a point where I was ready to do that. So to get back in touch with how my mother spoke, even some of the kind of the bits of the passages where she's trying to be witty and you could kind of hear her sense of humour or sarcasm coming through there. And it's, you know, kind of it's really nice to get back in touch with that. It was like she was having a conversation about her history research with me.
Was it a personal book for her? Because there are elements where you certainly think that it was a project that meant something to her, exploring the stories of these rebel prods, and a brilliant title as well.
Yes, indeed it was. And that was actually her title too. I think because she had a very unusual education, she had got a scholarship. She was from a working class part of Dublin, which was already quite unusual for an Irish Protestant in the South in the 1950s. She was born in the 40s, grew up in near Crumlin, basically, and then got a scholarship to Cloisteham OV, which was this all-Irish speaking boarding school to train all-Irish speaking sort of moderate nationalist primary school teachers who would then go into Protestant schools on behalf of the state and teach through Irish, and so raise a generation, if you like, of newly nationalist Protestant school children. It was always an underfunded college project, but it was the state's project, Cloisteham OV, to do that and to try and, I suppose, integrate the minority. And so my mother had been through this boarding school system, spoke fluent Irish, and I think spent a lot of the rest of her life trying to work out what the origins were of that educational experience that she'd had. And some of the people who taught her there had been involved, had been rebel prods themselves. So she was always aware there had been this Protestant nationalist element in the revolutionary period of kind of 1916 through to 23. And she wanted to know more about it. So it was a hugely personal thing for her. It was a search for origins, I think, in a way.
Because normally when we think of the 1916 Rising, we think of, well, we tend to think of it as maybe not having a very strong Protestant nationalist involvement. Or if we do think of those who are involved, it's more of the people like Casement or Markievicz who were maybe more from a more elite background, that we don't think of, well, as the book shows, 45 Protestants playing important roles.
Yes, and indeed she found more than 45. She actually found 90, but she didn't have time to write all the others up, and she wasn't able to follow them up in terms of documentation in as rich a way as the ones she focused in on in the book. And I think the thing is, there was a stereotype that fitted the aristocratic figures like Casement, like Markovitch. They were glamorous, they were wealthy, they were wild, they had unusual private lives. They fitted everything that was kind of the popular mythic stereotype about Irish Protestants. And the ordinary, boring, mundane, sort of middle and working class backbone Protestant of sort of the Dublin Protestant population was of less interest in a way because they were so ordinary. And also those key figures, those famous figures, were ones who converted. So they fitted a kind of redemptive narrative too. They found their true Irish Catholicism through their revolutionary experience. They returned to the true core of Irish nationalism, fitting with a narrative of 1916 in its aftermath. So I think these other figures got written out. They were certainly more ordinary. You know, they were glass fitters, they were working in factories, they were very much, many of them, ordinary inner city Dublin figures. Some of them were very poor. And people weren't really that interested in that story. And I think that is one of the reasons that they got written out over time. And we don't remember maybe the fact that before the 1916 rising, there is a huge generation of both Catholics and Protestants in Ireland who are excited about change, who are rebelling against their parents. What Foster calls the revolutionary generation. I mean, that's not a religious thing as such. It spans the religious divide. And if you look at the Howth gun running, for example, there's a huge Protestant involvement in that. These are exciting times. Young people, intelligentsia, they're getting caught up in it. And that's, I think, what the book is trying to recapture.
And not just Protestant men, but also Protestant women.
Indeed. And actually, one of the things that's interesting here is when you look at these Protestant women, they're very conformist in their religious practices. So they're still going to church on Sunday. They're still, you know, some of them become organists. They're very conventional. They're sort of not quite Miss Marple figures, but they're keeping this kind of very, very decorous Sunday church going practice. Yet in their other aspects of their political lives, they're very, very maverick. And actually, in some cases, they're also quite maverick in some of their private or familial lives. They're staying single. They're not marrying. And one wonders if the two things were being used to balance each other out. The suggestion in the book is that being conformist in their religious practice was one way of ensuring that they reached out to their communities and that they kept one common link that made them acceptable, even though politically they were on a very different path to the majority of Southern Unionists who remained Unionist. And that's important to say. The convention was Unionism. With gender, I think there was a space also within Protestantism in the south of Ireland at the time, different to the north, for this kind of independent woman. And that is something that's happening across a lot of Western Europe, and you see it in this circle, in these circles where these women can have independent lives, and are using that to pursue political aims.
Some of the lives that your mother explored really are quite extraordinary. There's the story of George Irvine, who was sentenced to death, although it was later commuted, and he was a teacher who played a really important role during the fighting.
Indeed, and it's interesting to speculate about what would have happened if Irvine had actually been executed, if there had been a Protestant executed as part of the initial wave of executions just after the rising. Would that have changed how we saw it, or would he also have been written out of the narrative in the way that Connolly, who was a free thinker, or Clark, who was actually, we think, actually a secular atheist, get turned into kind of good Catholics by the end of the 1916 commemorative narrative's development? But the Irvine case is very interesting because he was someone who had actually taught at St Andrews, who then goes on to take part in the rising at the South Dublin Union, St James's Hospital today. He's involved in the shooting. He's involved as a combatant in the rising. And one of the people who's killed there is a student, a former student of St Andrews, who's fighting on the British side. So you actually see there, in a way, the fault lines are running through Irish society at a very local, very personal level.
Why do you think the rebel prods were forgotten about afterwards? Why has it taken so long for their part in the story to be remembered?
There's a number of reasons for it, but I think obviously memory and history, what matters is that there's a constituency that wants to remember that group. And nobody really wanted to remember this group as time went on. For Southern Protestants in the new Free State, feeling vulnerable, very aware that many of them had been Unionists, and actually many of them remaining Unionists until the establishment of the Republic later on in the 40s. They were reluctant to highlight this group because that would throw light on the fact that most Southern Protestants had been Unionist. that this group were unusual. So they remained silent about them. They tolerated them. They unlike their northern brethren who tended to ostracize them, they tolerated them, but they didn't really want to shed light on them too much. For the Southern Republican narrative, they were really focused on the rising as a redemptive Easter myth, the moment of an Easter kind of uprising. Very much a Patrick Pearse's version of the rising is the one that really comes to the fore above the Young Irelander version, or above the kind of any kind of United Irishman version, which might have been there in the pre-1916 moment. It's really Pearse who is the victory, if you like, in the end, in terms of dominating the narrative. And even the socialists get sort of written out. And that kind of narrative, the Pearsean narrative, didn't have any space for Protestantism within it, really. And then, obviously, for the North, the Northern Irish state had no interest in remembering these rebel maverick Protestants who had actually, you know, gone over to what was seen as kind of the nationalist ultra Republican side. So there was no constituency wanted to remember them. And then the other thing was their actual cohort in the South disappears, because the working class Dublin Protestant world because of intermarriage disappears. The Natamere rule is very effective in ensuring that basically their children and grandchildren become Catholic. And the middle class cohort, again, many of them emigrate. And you see a group that doesn't have a successor constituency in the Republic to write their history. So I think that's why they're forgotten. And then the other element is obviously the conversion narrative is so powerful for the aristocrats. Markovitch, Casement, they're the figures that get all the attention because they are so exciting, so glamorous, so unusual. And there's an element of fantasy when people talk about Markovitch in later years, because she is this famous woman figure who's so unusual. It takes all the attention, I think.
Well, very good. The story at least now has been told in print. The book is called Rebel Prods, The Forgotten Story of Protestant Radical Nationalists and the 1916 Rising. It's published by the Ashfield Press and costs €25. The author is Valerie Jones. And joining us tonight was her daughter, Heather Jones. So, Heather, thank you so much. And congratulations on bringing the book through. And I think both your parents would be very proud of the way you have brought the book through to completion and the way you've spoken so movingly about it.
Thank you very much. And all author royalties go to the Irish Cancer Society.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History with Patrick Gagan on News Talk 106 to 108.
Welcome back to Talking History with me, Patrick Gagan. Now, a book I enjoyed reading over the weekend, well, it draws upon literature, cinema and popular romance to show how the changing position of women has shaped their dreams about men, from Lord Byron in the early 19th century to boy bands in the early 21st century. The book is called Heartthrobs, A History of Women and Desire. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs £20 sterling, so about €24. The author is Carol Dyhouse. And Carol, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me, Patrick.
It's a brilliant read because, well, I think you're trying to do something different here, because you're looking at men through the eyes of women.
That's right. And a starting point is the recently deceased art critic John Berger, who says that women are the objects of the male gaze. And that's quite a useful insight, which a lot of feminist writers have found very helpful in thinking about the world. But I wanted to turn it around and think, well, what if we looked at women looking at men instead of men looking at women?
And do you think the construction of these heartthrobs, is it an attempt to control sexuality, or is it an expression of sexuality?
Well, I think sex comes into it, but it's often about sort of fantasy and desire and dreams. I think I'm starting to explore how women dream about men in history and whether that's changed through time. You know, you could say, for instance, that if we go back to Jane Austen's time, women dreamt about men like Mr. Darcy because he was filthy rich and could be a provider and a protector. Whereas these days, because women can earn their own living, maybe they're looking for something a bit different.
And you explore the vampire phenomenon as well. And I suppose the vampire phenomenon from the earliest times.
Yes, it's a new draft of life in the 1980s, I think, when vampire movies and vampire romances become very, very popular, you know, sort of top-selling item on publishers' lists. And that's interesting in itself. You know, what is it about vampires that appeals particularly to young girls, when you think of Edward Cullen, or although he also appealed to mums, the Twilight mums phenomenon at the end of the last century. But I think it's interesting to ask why different kinds of masculinity become so fashionable at different moments in history. I mean, why do pirates become so popular in the 1940s, for instance? Or why do doctors become so popular in the 1950s? You think of Dr. Kildare or the huge popularity of the novel The Thornbirds, which also starred Dr. Kildare. But why do doctors, why do medical romances, hospital romances become such enormously popular and influential texts in the 1950s? So I think what I wanted to do was look at the extent to which changes in the social position of women can explain the kinds of men they fantasize about, and to look at how we might explain that.
And let's look at the interest in pirates and the interest then in doctors. Is it because it's a pleasant fantasy? Is it escapism? Does it reflect what's going on in the world at the time?
I think it's really complicated. I think it's easier with doctors because it was still quite hard for women to earn big salaries in the 1950s. It's still quite hard for women to earn big salaries. But, you know, there was very much after the Second World War, there was the feeling of the back to the home thing. You know, everybody, women particularly, wanted to have families. They wanted security. They wanted respectability. And a good guarantor of that was a doctor. You know, the medical profession was very respected and it offered good salaries and social stability. So marrying a doctor was a good bet in the 1950s, and the National Health Service was expanding, so there were more of them about. In that sense, I think you can understand that. But different things come into play when you say, well, pirates, you know, maybe there's a sort of rebellious streak in women, and going for bad boys, you know, actually has a different kind of appeal, but it is perhaps a fantasy appeal rather than a program for organizing your life. So I look at all those different factors. I mean, obviously not comprehensively because there are so many factors involved, but I think it becomes interesting to at least start to explore what it is that shapes our fantasies. In America, for instance, cowboy fantasies are very strong. And the writer Joan Didion said, you know, when John Wayne rode through her childhood, he altered forever the shape of her dreams. So, you know, where do we get our dreams from? Where do we get our ideas of what is desirable from?
Princess Diana, as a young girl, seems to have taken a lot of her ideas from the novels of I think, her step-grandmother, Barbara Cartland.
That's right.
But there's a suggestion that perhaps it might not have been the most healthy kind of way of finding out about romance.
I think Barbara Cartland herself said that, didn't she? She said that her books weren't awfully good for her. But yes, and my book does have a lovely photograph of the young Diana Spencer reading Barbara Cartland novels. They're full of princes, and they're full of, you know, princes are usually wealthy, not always, but usually wealthy, and offer a wonderful lifestyle, which Barbara Cartland engagingly once referred to as marrying Park Gates. So you marry the kind of income and the social position along with the man. And dreams of a prince are so old, aren't they? And this takes me back to my question, where do we get our dreams from? And, you know, we might get them from films, as Joan Didion did, watching John Wayne. We might get them from the reading of fairy tales. And I do have a chapter in the book about Prince Charming and the very old fantasy that so many women have about, you know, marrying a prince.
Do you think that in the 21st century, women have more taken control of the heartthrobs and the fantasies, and you see that they're now the consumers who know what kind of product they want?
Well, I do. Yes, I do think that they are more articulate consumers, and they are more articulate about what it is they desire. And they're not so dependent, as I said earlier, on marrying a major breadwinner. You know, they can contemplate different kinds of companionship and dream. So I do think that the 21st century has altered things. But then you get, you know, surprising throwbacks. I mean, we only have to think of the success of 50 Shades of Grey to think, oh, you know, goodness, maybe stuff hasn't gone as progressive as one hopes it has, you know, because you can point to tendencies both ways. I think you can show how women have got more independent, and you can show also how there is continuity with some of the sort of myths of the past. But the other way in which women as consumers have become more articulate about their needs, I think you can see them changing through the life cycle. So that the passion for boy bands is something which is really late 20th, early 21st century. You can't imagine Victorian girls going crazy over Justin Bieber types, can you? I think it would, you know, socially, it would be almost impossible to think of Victorian young ladies going to pop concerts. So the kind of growing independence of women has shaped the kinds of men that they fantasize about, and maybe the kinds of men that they fantasize about change through the life cycle.
Well, I think that's a brilliant note on which to end our discussion. Carol, congratulations on the book. It's called Heartthrobs, A History of Women and Desire. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs about €24 in hardback. The author is Carol Dyhouse. And Carol, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Patrick, for your interesting questions.
We'll be back with more on Talking History right after this.
Talking History with Patrick Gagan on Newstalk 106 to 108.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. Now, a novel that I enjoyed reading over the weekend was Eagles in the Storm. It's the final part of a brilliant trilogy by Ben Cain. It's published in paperback by Preface and costs £12.99 sterling, so about €15. And there were a few things that caught my eye when I was reading the book. First of all, the book is dedicated to Irish rugby players, past and present, and in particular to the late, great Anthony Foley. Then I noticed some references to shoulder to shoulder and stand up and fight and come on you boys in blue that made me think of Irish rugby. And then I did some investigation into the author and discovered that, well, he went to my old university, UCD, where he studied veterinary medicine. So, Ben, I realised I had to talk to you about how on earth you moved from veterinary medicine to becoming one of these brilliant historical fiction writers.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks for having me on the show. It was a bit of a long story, really. I worked as a vet for about 16 years, but I got kind of browned off with it, and I've always been fascinated with history. So I debated Vikings or Romans, and Bernard Cornwell's first novel about Uhtred, which is sort of Viking, came out at the time I was wondering about it. And I kind of thought, I can't write Vikings because Bernard Cornwell is. So I decided to do Romans, and I was working in Northumberland, Hadrian's Wall area at the time, foot and mouth disease as a vet, and long story short, thought the Romans would be a great thing. So I wrote a novel about the Romans on Hadrian's Wall, which never got published because all it involved was marching, as my agent said. But it got me an agent, and then I wrote another novel, which I got a book deal for, and that was it. I'm 11 books in now, so
11 books in and going strong. Well, talk to me about this trilogy, because it deals with, well, it deals with Lucilius Tullus, it deals with the capture of the legion's eagle, and it deals with an historical figure who actually was, so there are real life figures in it as well. How much historical research did you have to do for the book?
Quite a lot. I mean, I base my novels, all of them, on historical events to do with Rome and its enemies. And then I use the historical characters often in the books, but I people them with fictional characters as well, because that allows me the freedom to do things that we know the historical characters didn't. And so it's set, the trilogy's set from the years AD 9 to 16. So in September of AD 9, three Roman legions were wiped out in an unexpected attack and ambush in northern Germany. And that was 10% of the Roman army wiped out in one go, which was obviously a bit of a shock, and pretty much wiped out to a man, and their iconic eagles taken, generals killed, and so on. A few men survived. So the first book involved the ambush itself, and the second and third books, Eagles in the Storm being the third, tell the story of what happened in the years after and how the Romans looked for revenge to try and kill the mastermind of the ambush, whose name was Arminius, and to try and get their eagles back.
And it's clear from the book that you really have done your research in terms of how you describe the combat sequences, the military offensives, the even things down to the building of bridges and so on. And I do love the way you managed to bring in all of those references to Leinster rugby and Munster rugby and Irish rugby.
Yeah, I got a huge kick out of that. I've been a rugby fan since I was a kid. My dad used to take us down to Lansdowne Road And I don't know if any of your listeners remember the days when if you couldn't get a ticket, people who had extra ones used to give them to the guards who were on duty outside Lansdowne Road. I mean, you just think of that now. It's so nice. And you'd literally walk around the guards saying, has anyone given you a ticket? And we'd get in usually once to one game a year. And played rugby for Bective, not for UCD, very badly, I have to say. But a huge rugby fan and been to many matches. I went to the World Cup in Australia when Ireland were there, and I just have fun working stuff like that in. So stand up and fight is a really easy one to put in, obviously, when you're talking about Roman soldiers. And shoulder to shoulder is easy enough too. But Come On You Boys in Blue was very difficult. What I did, as you'll know from reading it, is I put a unit of the Roman soldiers who fought on ships were known as Marines, and it's known that they wore blue tunics. So I put a scene in with some Marines, and I said, "Come On You Boys in Blue," which was done. You know, it's kind of fun. And I dedicated the book. It was always going to be dedicated to the Irish rugby players of present and past. But when poor Anthony Foley died there last October, it was, I mean, I'm a Leinster man, but it was obviously a horrible thing. I'm 47. He was younger and he's got two kids. And, you know, I've got two kids. I just, like many people, I'm sure, in Ireland, was very struck by how sad it was for someone to be taken so young. So I actually contacted Shannon Rugby Club because there was a wonderful thing on BBC Radio 5 here in the UK by one of their journalists. And there's a eulogy on the wall of Shannon Rugby Club already to him. And it's very moving. And I asked permission to use that as the dedication of the book. And they couldn't. They got back to me. They said that was very nice, but they couldn't ask his wife Olive because it was so soon, and the book was going to print. So I said, that's obviously, you know, no problem. But I wanted to put something, so I just added in that extra dedication, which is, it's a very tiny thing, but you know, hopefully, you know, it'll just mean something to some people.
You've been involved in some wonderful fundraisers as well, and really quite extraordinary stuff, including the Walking of Hadrian's Wall, where you were wearing full Roman gear.
That's right. One of my big things when I gave up veterinary was I said I'd get very fit, I'd be able to exercise all the time, but I'm like most people, I'm quite lazy. So about 4 years into being a full-time writer, I was fatter than I had been when I was a vet. So I decided that I'd do something extreme because I'm a bit like that. So Hadrian's Wall path, I'd always wanted to do it. I thought, right, I'll do it as a Roman soldier. And I know quite a few other Roman authors. So two friends of mine, Anthony Riches and Russell Whitfield, they agreed after quite a few beers that it'd be a great idea. And we all did it in April 2013. And we raised nearly £20,000 for charity. So that was quite a shock how much money we raised. And so we did it again the following year in Italy, and we raised nearly £27,000. And then last year I cycled 1,500 miles from Barcelona to Rome following Hannibal, the General Hannibal's trail through the Alps. So that was mad. That was a month of cycling, really hard cycling, and I raised nearly £20,000 again. So it's extraordinary. I never would have thought when I was a vet that I'd be able to raise so much money for charity while doing crazy things. But it's just amazing how much money people will give you when you're, you know, dressed as a Roman and you say you're going to walk 100 miles, whatever.
Brilliant. So I suppose the message there for all our listeners is that it doesn't really matter what you study in college. You can study veterinary medicine and still end up being a world famous writer of historical fiction. Or indeed, you could just be a vet. It'll all work out one way or the other. My thanks to Ben Kane, author of the wonderful Eagles in the Storm. It's published in paperback by Preface. Costs about €15. And Ben, thanks a million for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much, Patrick. It's very kind. Thanks.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History with Patrick Gagan on News Talk 106 to 108.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. Well, we're always obsessed with magic and witchcraft, whether it's the Wizard of Oz or Harry Potter. But how far back does the history of witchcraft and magic go? I'm delighted to welcome to the show Owen Davies, who's a world acknowledged expert on the subject. And his new book is a collection of essays, The Oxford Illustrated History of Witchcraft and Magic. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs £19.99 sterling, so about €24. The editor is Owen Davies. And Owen, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
So let's talk about then, I suppose, how far back we can go with this history of witchcraft and magic. How far back can you begin a study?
Well, we see evidence that people are practicing magic to protect themselves, to provoke love, to in a sense just try and deal with the misfortunes of the world. We get evidence for this right back in the dawn of history, at the very earliest sort of texts, when we're looking at sort of cuneiform clay tablets from Mesopotamia, some 4,000, 5,000 years ago, we see people practicing magic. So it's clearly something which individuals, cultures, and societies have been thinking through, working out, and recording right back to the dawn of civilization.
And has there always been a tension between religion and magic, and between the followers of religion and magic?
It's a really tricky definition, and many historians and anthropologists have tried to try and find what the relationship is between magic and religion. But it's really best understood in terms of the context of the time in which it's being used at different periods and different societies. And often it's a term which is used to label another whose religion you disapprove of. You see this over and over again. So the early Christians referred to the pagans of ancient Greece and Rome as practicing magic rather than religion. And we see it again, for example, during the Reformation, when Protestants accused Catholics of performing magic. So it's, the relationship of the two is always about tensions between opposing or different religious cultures.
People are always obsessed with the story of the witch trials, and there's a wonderful essay in the collection on the witch trials. Why did that seem to sweep Europe and the American colonies for a period and become so overpowering?
It's a fascinating question, because when we look at all these sources from the ancient world through the medieval period, we find there are figures known as witches, people who were doing magic for harmful purposes, particularly, and most, in terms of definition, about doing it out of envy and spite. That's the kind of archetypal definition of a witch. So why did it happen? Why did it happen in the 16th century? One of the key reasons, I think, is to do with the rise of the printing press. It's the spread, the quick spread of knowledge, tied in with a series of heresy trials that were taking place in Central Europe in the 14th, 15th, and 16th century as well. So we have this slow but growing concern by the Catholic Church that there is growing evil, that the Satan is increasing his works in the world. And the use of torture in these heresy trials creates this whole new dynamic where people start confessing, naming names, that there seems to be a conspiracy, a growing conspiracy out there to undermine Christianity. And these sort of confessions are then, for the first time, printed. They're disseminated in books by demonologists, by Dominican monks. And slowly but surely, the fear spreads as these books with these confessions spread as well. So slowly but surely, by the time we get to the 16th century, there's a widespread concern that witches were just one aspect of the ways in which Satan was increasing his grip over the world.
And the fear of witches seems to have continued for many centuries afterwards.
Yeah, it's the story of witchcraft often ends in the history books within the 18th century, when the trials themselves wind down, when the laws against witchcraft are rescinded, when the kind of common assumption is that the Enlightenment does away, that people become more sceptical, that the common people get more educated, etc. But in fact, when you look at the criminal records, when you look at the newspaper reports of the 18th and 19th centuries, you find that there are thousands of people who were persecuted, beaten up, and even killed as witches right across Europe and into America as well. So witchcraft was an ongoing
concern for the vast majority of people. And it's got nothing to do with people being educated. It's about, again, people trying to make sense of the world and trying to explain the misfortunes that happen to them.
There is a wonderful final essay in the collection which looks at witches on the screen. So it looks at The Wizard of Oz and Harry Potter and television shows as well, like the comedy Bewitched and the series from, I think, the 1990s, early 2000s, Charmed, and the image of the ugly witches which pervaded for so long.
Mm. Well, what we get with particularly with cinema and then TV, as you say, in the 80s and 90s, is the idea, this sort of juxtaposition of our classic perception of the stereotype of the old, ugly, hag-like witch, which you see in representations right back in the 16th century, woodcuts showing exactly the same sorts of figures as you get of the sort of the witches in The Wizard of Oz, for example. And at the same time, during the 20th century, through television and cinema, we get the development of the sort of sexually attractive young witch, and the witch is someone who does good rather than harm as well. So, you know, the ways in which the demands of cinema and TV have shaped the ways in which popular culture sees witches is really quite fascinating. And today we have sort of multiple views of what a witch is.
Do we still live in a world of magic?
Well, I think we do. I mean, the old sort of rationale for human evolution in terms of mental terms was that people moved from a stage of magic primitivism to religion and organized religion and then to an age of science. And apparently, you know, according to this early anthropological model, we are now in the age of science and that we really shouldn't be believing in witchcraft and magic anymore. But it's clear that there's always been an age of science, there's always been an age of religion, and always been an age of magic. It seems that there's something in us, or lots of us, that wants to believe in magic. And of course, we encourage our children to live in a magical universe. And it's only when they become adults that we decide that it's no longer appropriate.
And of course, some of the things that are scientifically possible now, if a scientist attempted that or had attempted that back in the past, they would have been seen as a magician.
Yeah, because the relationship between science and magic is very close. And a lot of people who were accused of magic, of practicing magic during the witch trial era, were actually, you know, cutting-edge scientists, people who were putting their lives on the line with the Inquisition, for example, to really try and understand what they saw as the hidden or occult properties of the world that they thought God had created.
Okay, well, congratulations. It's an absolutely superb collection of essays, The Oxford Illustrated History of Witchcraft and Magic. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs about €24. The editor of the collection is Owen Davies. And Owen, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Now, to end the show tonight, we are looking at Hitler's American model, how the United States was involved, or certainly influenced the Nazis when they were making their race laws in the 1930s. James Whitman, a brilliant historian, has told this story in a new book published in hardback by Princeton University Press. And when I caught up with him earlier in the week, I began by asking him about how this book will really surprise quite a lot of readers, because they won't be aware that Hitler and the Nazis based some of their laws on the United States.
That's right. It's, of course, hard to imagine that the Nazis would have looked to anybody else for lessons in racism. But the fact of the matter is that in the early 20th century, the United States was the leading racist jurisdiction in the world. There was a lot more to the U.S. than that, of course, but it was the home of a great deal of inventive race-based legislation, which the Nazis found quite interesting.
Because we have all of these dismissive comments by Hitler about the United States, that it was a rubbish dump and he thought it was an inferior country, but yet he praised American law and Mein Kampf.
Well, his views of America changed in the late 1930s. Before then, he, like many European right-wingers, tended to look to the United States as the title of my book, a model, at least, the home of some, as the Nazis put it, exciting innovations in the making of race-based order.
So let's look at the laws then that influenced Hitler and the Nazis. It really seems to have been crucial in the development of the Nuremberg Laws in 1935.
Well, I believe that's the case, in particular in one regard. The Nuremberg Laws established reduced Jews to second-class citizenship and also introduced the criminalization of racially mixed marriage and sexual relations between Jews and so-called Aryans, as the Nazis called them, particularly in the second respect, when it came to the criminalization of racially mixed marriage. The United States really offered the model in this period. 30 of the states in the United States banned and sometimes draconianly criminalized interracial marriage. This was something for which there was really no other example at the time on the globe.
There's a really compelling map in your book which shows the United States, and it has it's done up to show the states where there's anti-African American legislation and how they're able to have these racial laws in the United States. And it seems that the Nazis were heavily influenced not just by laws against African Americans, but also the Indian reservations and the treatment of Native Americans, and it gave them a number of different ideas.
That's true. The treatment of Asians also was something that the Nazis discussed quite a lot. They saw the United States legal order as one that targeted coloreds very broadly and not just blacks.
So talk to me about the Bremen incident, because that seems to have been something that really triggered some of these thoughts among the Nazis.
Indeed, and it's quite a story. In New York in the summer of 1935, a crowd of protesters clambered aboard the Bremen, which was the most famous of the German ocean liners at the time, tore down the swastika flag and threw it into the Hudson River. This created a major diplomatic incident. Five of the protesters were arrested. There was a great deal of agitation in the German press against these protesters. But things really came to a head, though, after a few weeks when a Jewish magistrate in a New York police court released the five protesters, issuing an opinion declaring Nazism to be a form of barbarism. This, as it turned out, played into the hands of the Nazis. Up until that point, the swastika flag had not been the exclusive flag of Nazi Germany. The Nazis, who shared power in some ways, at least, with nationalist conservatives, were compelled to permit the flying also of a flag intended to represent the conservative interest in German politics. But Goebbels, as a result of the Bremen incident, seized on the opinion of this Jewish magistrate, and it was that motivated the Nuremberg laws, the calling of the Reichstag in Nuremberg, to pass anti-Jewish laws and to make the swastika flag the exclusive flag of Germany.
Yeah, and so that set off a whole train of events that of course, we all know where that ended. And yet there were times when the Nazis looked at American laws and thought they were too harsh.
They did. It's a depressing fact. In particular, when it came to American classifications, racial classifications, many of the American states had what was called the one-drop rule, that persons who had only one drop of black blood counted as black. That's something the Nazis found quite extreme, and certainly they never made any effort to introduce anything quite that dramatic into their own classifications. It's also the case that the Nazis found some of American Jim Crow to be puzzling and extreme.
Okay, so some of the racial legislation. How does this change our views then of the United States? Does it force us to reevaluate what was going on in America, not just in the 1930s, but in the decades leading up to it?
Well, it certainly brings home the depth of American racism and of what's called, of course, in the American tradition, white supremacy. It does more than that, though. What appealed to the Nazis was not just American racism. Of course, racism was not exclusive to the United States at the time. What appealed to the Nazis was the innovativeness of American lawmaking, the willingness of Americans to overturn juristic traditions in the name of creating a new race order. It was that kind of zesty radicalism in American law that inspired the most radical Nazis, who were, in fact, the greatest enthusiasts for the American model.
Okay, well, James, congratulations on a superb work. It's called Hitler's American Model, The United States and the Making of Nazi Race Law. It's published in hardback by Princeton University Press. It costs $19.95 sterling, so about €23. The author is James Whitman. And James, thank you so much for bringing this story to our attention.
Thank you.
And that was James Whitman talking to me about his new book, Hitler's American Model, The United States and the Making of Nazi Race Law, published in hardback by Princeton University Press. And that brings us to the end of another edition of Talking History. I'd like to thank everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cattle and Ronan Branagh, who produced the show tonight, Aisling Bonner on research, and Lee Duncan on sound. Well, next week I'm going to be away, but Tommy Graham will be in the chair, and he'll be looking at the history of Valentia Island, and he'll be exploring the development of the transatlantic telegraph cable and lots more besides. So join him next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.